Good afternoon, and welcome to Central Coast Voices. I'm your host, Fred Monroe. I guess I should say sometimes I'm your host today, Fred Monroe, because on alternate weeks you get Chris Kington Parker, and she is our host on alternate weeks. The goal of Central Coast Voices is to bring you credible and valid information and insights from diverse members of our community. Central Coast Voices addresses how today's choices will affect tomorrow's community and how we look at the long-term ramifications of changes in our society. Sometimes those are not changes, sometimes those are constants, so we'll talk about that also. We are a product of and a project of the Action for Healthy Communities. Action for Healthy Communities puts out a report every 3 years that's a broad snapshot of things going on in San Luis Obispo County, both economically environmentally and socially and all those kinds of issues. It's a report called Vital Signs. The last report came out in late 2013. We're currently working on putting together the most current report, which will be out in December of 2016. If you'd like to see a copy of that report, it's downloadable and or reviewable online at www.actionslo.org. So that's the word action run together with slo.org. It is available for you without charge, and we'd like you to be able to have that information if you'd like it. Today we're going to take a topic that we have looked at lightly before, but we're going to look at it a little more heavily now. Basically, democracy's challenges and democracy's choices and how those affect our community. We're into another election cycle. Actually, my notes say another election cycle approaches, but I think it's realistic to say now that an election cycle is with us. They seem to get here earlier and earlier every time. There's a number of important choices coming up that will affect both our community locally and the nation as a whole. Today I have with me Michael Latner, who you're familiar with because he's been here before, Associate Professor of Political Science and Director of the Master of Public Policy Program at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, and Lindsay Lupo, who is a Professor of Political Science and Director of the Institute of Politics and Public Service at Point Loma Nazarene University. That's down by San Diego. And as we want to really look at the shaping of the election cycle that's coming up. There's lots of things that are different in this cycle, but also they're the same, and in ways that's a dichotomy we don't always get a chance to sort out very well. But both the behavior of the electorate and the behavior of those people who are trying to get our votes comes into question often, and it's one of the challenges we have with us. And let's start with Michael. Michael, we've had this discussion before. For a lot of our listeners who may not recall, you have been interviewed on this program before, and you've also been a good source of political information for the news department at this station. The election cycle we are getting into now, everybody figures it's going to be just like every other election cycle, and the more we say that, the more they're different all the time. What's happening already that we need to be paying attention to? Is anything happening already that's a surprise?
Well, thank you for having me, Fred. There are a number of conditions that make this a particularly interesting election cycle from a political science perspective, if we focus just on the presidential election for the time being. Election scholars and folks that follow electoral politics have a number of variables that they often refer to as the fundamentals that are useful in predicting and shaping electoral outcomes. And with the 2016 cycle, a number of the fundamentals are more or less a sort of wash, and that means that there are going to be other factors that are more prevalent than they normally are. So, for example, if we look at the incumbent party's popularity, President Obama's approval ratings, his favorability ratings is right now in the mid to high 40s, and that is just about average for historical presidential elections.
Now, even you've mentioned that, but for a lot of the population, they say we keep hearing, oh, that's not as good as it should be, that this is a reflection on things that he's done that are not as popular as people expected them to be.
Sure.
But the recurring theme is that is indeed pretty much where everybody is in year six of a two-term presidency.
Well, it's not so much that it's where everyone is, but that if a president is at about that level, then it won't have much of an effect on the chances of the incumbent party's candidate. That is, if Obama's ratings were crept up into the 50s, into the mid-50s, that would be a very good sign for the Democratic nominee, whoever he or she was. If, on the other hand, Obama's favorability rating started to slip into the low 40s, that would not be good for the Democratic nominee. And so where it's at now really sort of washes out in terms of it being a useful predictive variable in determining what the outcome is going to be. Similarly, the economy, right? There's a lot of discussion about how people vote with their pocketbooks, and if the economy is on a downturn, that tends to result in a lower favorability for the incumbent party. And so if the economy is not doing well, if unemployment is higher than expected, then that will tend to people will punish the incumbent party. But if we look at the unemployment rate over the last few quarters, it's pegged at about 2.5%, which, again, is almost exactly at the historical average. And so it's not higher than usual. It's not lower than usual. And therefore, it's not a really good predictor of how it's going to affect the election.
Does the incumbent party have the ability to use that this time in a way that says, gee, we've recovered from the recession, things are going better, we're back where we should be?
Sure.
Okay, but the challenging party in this case, the Republicans, have the ability to say, no, we really, because it was so lousy, it should have been doing better by now, and therefore we're still very disappointed. And how does that play with the public?
Sure. Well, the opposition party always has the virtue of being able to argue what should have been, right, without actually having, looked at what could be. So should the economy have improved faster or at a stronger pace if there were different economic policies put in place? Possibly, but that it's all conjecture. And so, and likewise, the Obama administration is going to lay out their case and try to make a strong argument, and the Democratic candidates will lay out their case that this has been a strong recovery and that we're a lot better off than we were when we started.
Okay, as we look at this topic, we've looked at it with an effort to keep it as objective as possible, but an awful lot of things have happened recently. So that I think put us in a position where we have to look at or at least talk about some of the key things that have gone on both sides. For the Democrats, everybody was for a long time assuming that Hillary Rodham Clinton was the shoe-in candidate.
Sure.
Okay, and now there's more discussion and frustration over her emails as Secretary of State. Some of that frustration is coming from the State Department and the Justice Department that are in a bit of a battle, and those are all on, if you will, the incumbent side of the discussion, so that's not looking well in some regards. The flip side is that I don't think anybody would have thought that there would be 17 viable Republican candidates. 17 candidates is not a surprise, I think, but 17 that are looking reasonably viable is a surprise. So is this for people like you a shocking place to be a year before the election?
Oh, there's no question that the number of legitimate or potentially legitimate Republican candidates is a historical anomaly. Typically, back when conventions actually determined who the nominees were going to be in parties, there was this process that worked a lot faster than it does today, where candidates were vetted by party insiders and by party elites, and that process was much more inside baseball. Today, in a media-dominated nomination process that's much more fragmented than it was, you know, even 20, 30 years ago, this is more of an open process. And parties are continually struggling to control the process with more competitors, with journalists and the media and citizen activists and interest groups. And it's a much more complex process than it was.
Well, after some of the decisions of the Supreme Court that have affected campaign finance or how organizations can put money up for candidates, whether the candidate wants the money used in that way or not, those seem like we have more people in a position to attempt to buy elections. I bring that up specifically because what occurs to me is that as you have people attempting to buy elections, sometimes the people who are attempting to buy elections are spending their money to buy a primary election that will not put them in a position to be successful in the general election. And how do you balance that out? And is that different than what we've seen in the past? It appears different to me, but I am a layman to this discussion.
Sure. That's something that we should talk about in more detail. There are really, I think, three distinct processes that happen. And most citizens are familiar with the most visible and traditional part of the electoral process, which is the electoral primary, right? The nomination process and the electoral process by which candidates are weeded out and you get a nominee for the Democratic and Republican Party. But in addition to that process, which has changed, and we should talk about those changes, there's the invisible primary or the party primary, and then there's the money primary. And the invisible primary is sort of the pre-primary, right? It's where the party elites get together. It's this process that I alluded to that traditionally the elites in the party are forced to deal with the coalitions within any party, within the Democratic Party and within the Republican Party. There are groups of individuals and actors that are seeking to control the party itself, to determine what the party's goals are and what the legislative agenda is going to be. And they basically have to fight it out within the party and deal with the tension between wanting a candidate that represents their principles and their legislative goals and a candidate that's electable. And those two things are often not the same, right? The more ideologically pure your candidate is, the less electable they are. And so the party elites have to have this infighting that goes on in terms of, and you can see this happening now, right, with the endorsements coming out. Mm-hmm. Endorsements are an important way to signal loyalty to one faction over another. And that process is underway now. The second part of the process that's underway now is the money primary. And as you alluded to earlier, that has changed fundamentally in terms of not just the amounts of money that are being fed into the process, but also the organizational and associational structure by which we fund campaigns.
Okay. At the risk of getting myself in trouble here, the issue that seems to come up and is a recurring theme that I hear about a lot is that oftentimes parties figure out pretty early who can get elected, and they manipulate the process enough to get an electable candidate out there. There's a lot of discussion now about who is or isn't an electable candidate. At the risk, I've got to pick an example. You have Donald Trump on one side, which is the most popular Republican candidate in most polling now. Okay, then an awful lot of people are saying, regardless of what you think about him or don't think about him, he's highly unlikely to be electable in a general election. You have Bernie Sanders, who for a lot of people on the other side are saying the same thing, and that is he may be a wonderful person, he may have some great possibilities, and there are people who just think he is much of a fringe candidate on the right and then left, as Donald Trump is on the right. And if you nominated him, there's no way he could be elected. Okay. That may be an interest, and that's, again, not my judgment, but the judgment of what we're hearing a lot of about this. But there seems to be a tendency to be an interesting groundswell of energy for some of those non-electable candidates. How do the parties address that? Are they doing anything to address it, or is it just going to be a runaway train?
No, I think that if you look at what party leaders are doing, you can see them trying to deal with it now. Some of them frantically so.
But I think their frantic efforts don't lend them to looking very professional in the process, if you will. When you're looking at someone who is running for president or heavily involved in somebody running for president, when they look like a frantic individual, that their franticness affects people's judgment of that individual. So that kind of behavior sometimes is counterproductive, and I'm wondering how this balances out. Are there, and maybe I'm wrong, maybe there is no such thing as an unelectable candidate in a general election.
No, there most certainly is. I mean, I think the clearest historical example was Barry Goldwater.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, McGovern comes to mind as well. And parties work very hard. They've learned those lessons historically. And so as the primary process gets underway and before the first votes are ever cast, party leaders within each of the states are working very hard to organize and make sure that a candidate that can actually win has the advantage of that party organization. And so that's really where the establishment comes into play, is the statewide committees and the national committees will be coordinating feverishly to produce a candidate that is electable.
Mm-hmm.
There's virtually no chance Donald Trump is going to be the Republican nominee.
There's no chance.
Virtually no chance.
Virtually, okay.
We live in a probabilistic world.
Okay. All right, well, because I don't know how you predict that when the man generally is holding the highest popular stand in the Republican Party.
But that's a function of the fragmentation of the vote, right? He's in the mid-20s, and he's probably going to stay in the mid-20s.
Okay. Lindsay is with us on the phone, so I thank you for your patience, Lindsay. I want to bring you into the discussion. Let's start with, is there anything that Michael has said so far that we need to pay better attention to because we shouldn't listen to him all the time?
Or correct.
No, I would agree with everything he said. Like he said just recently in just that last comment, I would agree that there is virtually no chance that Trump could end up as the nominee. And I would even throw in some other sort of less egregious factional candidates into that group, you know, Ted Cruz, Rand Paul, because many of the party's sort of rising stars, they're really not in a great position to end up winning the nomination because they really do just appeal to one faction. So Trump might even sustain those numbers, the polling numbers, but that will never be enough to actually get him the nomination.
Okay. The flip side is, though, on the Democratic side, everybody presumed that Hillary Rodham Clinton was going to just walk through this.
Mm-hmm.
The trouble that she's getting into now is not coming from the right necessarily. You know, Benghazi may come back to haunt her later on, but the email issue is to some extent an internal issue within the government that she was part of that is still in power. How does that fare with the general populace?
Well, I think one thing that people need to remember in watching her sort of approaching this election cycle, or as you said earlier, we're already in it, is that, you know, in the fall of 2007, the media had pretty much coronated Hillary Clinton and said that she was going to be the candidate. There was some talk of Obama, but, you know, it was a lot of talk of he's too new, he's too fresh, and is the country ready for a black president? And so all signs were pointing to Clinton as late as the fall of 2007, and clearly that changed drastically. So I think it's really too early for us to say, you know, she does have this 35-point lead right now. Does it seem like anybody could sort of overtake that? But I think that they could. You know, we'll know more from Biden by the end of this week. And we can't say for certain that somebody else won't step into the campaign. In terms of the emails, sure, that's going to hurt her. But what she has in her favor is that we still have more than a year before the election, so she would not be the first candidate to face some heightened scrutiny on an issue like this or sort of at this level, but then has been able to overcome it. So she has time in her favor right now.
There's been some discussion, it's also been a challenged discussion, that the Republican Party is currently in a position where the electorate is not likely to be the overall electorate is not likely to be very fond of whoever they put out there. The demographics, the minority population, the female population, seems to be a major contributing factor to who is an electable candidate. And Michael talked before about the fact that we used to have the powers that be in a party through the convention being having the ability to pretty much anoint who they wanted to be the candidate to be. Now, after Citizens United and other things, we see a tremendous amount of money having usurping some of that authority, if you will, of the parties. Is that something that we're not paying good enough attention to? Is it something we're paying too much attention to?
No, I mean, I think that is absolutely right. The parties have been losing power, sort of this rise of advocacy groups, issue groups, the super PACs, they're sort of losing control of the money. But at the end of the day, the system consistently seems to work, right? So overall, in terms of the way that the primaries play out, they do tend to push the moderate candidates to the forefront and the more electable candidates. So I think that despite what we sort of experience in this phase of the campaign and sort of what seems like a very sort of factionalized atmosphere, that eventually everyone starts to move to a sort of more moderate space as we approach the general election.
Okay. That's a point I want to get back to, but I want to kind of shift to one of the things going on in California. An editorial from one of the columnists of the Sacramento Bee that I was able to read in the last couple of days talks about the top two-tier primary process in California, with a recurring theme that whether you like it or don't like it, it tends to give you moderated front runners who become moderated office holders. I don't see anything that's going on the national level that's even not necessarily similar to that process, but how primaries are going on are still so controlled by the states. Even at parties within the states, I'm wondering if we even need to pay much attention to the early primaries for a presidential race.
I do think that sort of the lore that Iowa used to have in New Hampshire is starting to disappear. I mean, the reason that these early states used to matter so much was because that was sort of what garnered attention on one particular candidate. But in an age of sort of information overload, we just don't need them as much anymore to sort of cue us in the direction of voting. And we've seen this for the last few election cycles, where the candidates that have won New Hampshire or Iowa do not go on to win the nomination. And so I think that the media will start to sort of pick up on this. The general voting public will start to pick up on this, that there needs to be sort of less of this focus on the primaries. And in terms of the top two system, California is definitely this sort of petri dish, if you will, of sort of experimenting with what that's going to look like. And I know that they're fighting a lot of legal battles around the country about trying to take on some of these closed primaries. So the research is really sort of split on what that top two system produces in terms of the type of candidate and whether or not it sort of helps third parties or whether or not it punishes third parties and whether it produces a more moderate candidate. And quite honestly, we have to question, do we want more moderate candidates? There's always sort of this assumption that that's the place that we want to land is with this moderation. If there's one thing to be said about polarization, it's that at the very least we get clear choices.
Indeed.
Yeah, you get clear choices, but I think for some people, both choices become scary choices, even though they might be clear. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Michael, go ahead and jump in.
One of the problems might be that there's only two choices, and if they're polarized choices, that's a somewhat of a separate conversation. But in terms of the traditional Iowa-New Hampshire effect, I think Lindsay hits it right on the nose, the effect is being attenuated, and not just by the fragmentation of media and the nationalization of the presidential race itself, but in part by the money. I mean, one of the things that used to matter, if a candidate who was not a party favorite, who was running more of a grassroots campaign, was successful in those early primaries, then they would gain notoriety, attention, and money. And one of the filtering effects of that primary process was that if you didn't do well in the early primaries, then the money faucet gets shut off. And today that is no longer the case when you have a few individuals that can finance a candidate, and you end up getting something like the new Gingrich effect in the last presidential election, where Gingrich was able to hold on even though a number of party elites were trying to get him out of the race, and he prolonged the primary process because he had good funding.
Well, that brings up a very good question then, which is one place I wanted to go from this discussion, was if you talk to the average voter, they will tell you that you can't buy their vote. They'll tell you that the advertising that hits the media is not what persuades them to vote for someone they want to support. But reality is the person who spends the most money wins the election. Until you get down to very, very close races and beyond most of the primaries. The example that comes up is the Swift Boat campaign against John Kerry. Okay, people spent a lot of money coming up with a program to discredit his war record. The average voter would still say to you, you know, that kind of fringe radical advertising is not what sways my vote, but it affected affected his standing, and it affected where he was in the process. So how do we address the balance between what people believe makes a difference in what they're going to decide, and the fact that for a lot of us it still looks like you're able to buy an election?
Well, there are, I think as we started off the program, we discussed some of the major factors that, mm-hmm. that determine the outcome of elections. And there is no question that campaigns matter, or else they wouldn't spend as much money on mm-hmm. Trying to persuade voters and mobilizing voters as they do. And so I think, you know, once you've accounted for the fundamentals in any given campaign season, campaign strategy certainly matters, and it matters because elections are not simply a sort of mathematical device to, you know, allocate votes to seats and determine winners. There are cultural rites of passage, and so an election campaign is one of the ways that we know that we're a democracy, and there's a lot of culture tied up into that, and so campaigns work not this is one of the areas of controversy as to why campaigns aren't more policy oriented. Well, campaigns aren't as much policy oriented as some would like because they're ultimately matters of morality and culture, mm-hmm. and they are part of how we bestow leadership on elites. And so all those cultural symbols are used in the campaign process, and it certainly motivates, it angers voters, it turns some away, it mobilizes others, but it definitely has an effect.
Lindsay,
I'll just jump in if I could agree with Mike, and that a voter will tell you that they don't pay attention to the media, and they might actually believe that, but they matter. They matter very, very much. And like Mike said, that is why they're all chasing the money, because that's how they pay for those ads. And, you know, you'd be hard-pressed to find a voter that would say, you know, I really like negative ads. You know, they really just add to my day and the sort of mudslinging. But the research pretty clearly points to the fact that negative ads work. And with the Swift Vote example that you mentioned, we see how that can take down a candidate. And I heard the phrase used this week, the post-policy candidate, in reference to Donald Trump, and I had to sort of laugh because he's clearly not the first post-policy candidate. I mean, they've sort of always figured out that to talk in depth about particular policies is not the way, sadly, that you win an election. As Mike alluded to, it has a lot more to do with sort of your charismatic presentation on a stage and your sort of ability to show a sense of leadership, and that's sort of for better or worse.
Okay. The unaffiliated voter has been the independent voter, but the unaffiliated voter is what comes to my mind as an explanation for it, because there's an awful lot of independent voters who are really or call themselves independent voters that are actually aligned with a party already, or aligned with a clear philosophy that goes with a party. But the unaffiliated voters, we had heard about a lot. It seems to be less of a topic of discussion. I realize it's less of a topic of discussion now because we're still in the primary process. We've barely started the primary process. But that is that going to be a different part of the part of the motivation for candidates to look at where they want to be in the perception of the public than it has been in the past?
Yeah, no, the number of unaffiliated voters has been increasing for the past few decades. And so candidates will have to sort of moderate their tone and the particular policies that they push to try to appeal to those groups. But also, as you mentioned, many of those so-called independent voters are party leaners. So they don't identify formally with a party, but ideologically they do lean one way. So candidates don't have to sort of adjust as much as we might think, because it perhaps isn't as different as from a few decades ago. But one thing I think that we really should be paying attention to with the unaffiliated voters is the youth vote, because 18 to 29-year-olds are overwhelmingly unaffiliated, and their numbers are rising in terms of their voter turnout. So we've seen bumps in the last two election cycles, and so the candidates are going to have to speak not only to the unaffiliated, but the young unaffiliated, and sort of figure out how to capture that vote.
Is anybody specifically paying attention to that and doing an effective job already on the Republican side of this?
I think Marco Rubio is trying to. I think in a field of that many candidates, he's using his youth to try to connect with some of those voters, sort of moderating some of his stances to try to appeal to them and try and sort of reach out to those who have a particular stance, perhaps on abortion or immigration, and most particularly gay rights.
Yeah, absolutely. There are really two different kinds of independents, with air quotes, although I'm on radio, so you can't see my air quotes.
Okay.
And you know, we see these two groups, and they've been changing dynamically over the last few decades. It used to be that when you referred to an independent voter, you were talking about someone who, on average, was just less engaged in the political process. And what has really changed over the last few decades, as Lindsay points out, is this emergence of young voters. And these are people that have come of age politically in this polarized party period, right? So they have known nothing but these very polarized parties, which is, you know, fairly recent. You know, if you go back over 4 or 5 decades, when you were coming of age, Fred, the parties were more dynamic and more diverse internally, right?
Yeah.
There were liberal Republicans and conservative Republicans and conservative Democrats and liberal Democrats, and that's no longer the case. We now have these two more ideologically pure parties, and so the types of young voters that consider themselves independent are independent because they're not motivated purely by partisanship, and they don't really see either party representing their interests on the whole. And they are engaged. They're engaged in all sorts of civic engagement, and they're engaged politically, often outside the two-party system. But they're not disengaged independents that we used to refer to. And so they're becoming an increasingly important part of the electorate. And it's one of the reasons why Marco Rubio and Bernie Sanders on the left, frankly, are reaching out. Rand Paul, to some extent, too. I think you see them trying to – they see this coalition, and they understand its importance. It's also one reason why there's a sort of built-in advantage for what you might call generic Democrat or generic – Republican, and that's the Bush and Clinton candidates, right? I mean, their campaigns, neither of those campaigns are going to have to move too far to the center or moderate their views come the general election, whereas these other candidates, both on the left and the right, would have to move considerably and moderate their positions.
Okay. So you'd consider a generic candidate an already moderated candidate?
Yes, someone who has clear party principles, they're in with the party establishment, or they are the party establishment in this case, and they don't have to go through this process where they are appealing to partisans during the primary process and then trying to moderate their views to be more appealing to a general electorate come November.
Okay. The process we're talking about is, by the way, for those of you who are listening, and I'm sorry, I've gotten caught up in the discussion and forgot to remind you that this is Public Radio KCBX. This is a fascinating topic. We're really talking about where the democracy we live in is going as we look at the start of the 2016 election season. And my guests today are Michael Latner, Associate Professor of Political Science and Director of the Master of Public Policy Program at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, and Lindsay Lupo, who is the Professor of Political Science and Director of the Institute of Politics and Public Service at Point Loma Nazarene University. And I apologize for not reintroducing you both before that. I've got kind of caught up in the discussion and listening to both of what you have to say. I'm wondering, I'm stuck with it to some extent because it may not be a discussion that's gone on very much, but every once in a while we still hear about the frustration with the Electoral College process and the whole issue of balancing the public vote versus the electoral vote, and when they don't match up, how people feel about that. I get the impression that as the center becomes a little bit grayer area and an awful lot of elections are won by the center, if we're going to see that be a recurring theme. It kind of went away in the 2012 election because we had an incumbent in office who was running again and succeeded in the election. But obviously it came into play and there were some concerns about it in 2008. But it goes back to the year 2000, and whether or not the Electoral College is a burden or a safety valve on our process. I invite either of you to jump in.
Well, certainly to the extent that we are likely to see close presidential elections, that is, the margin of victory is going to be smaller. It's not going to be a strong majority like Obama had or like Bush had in 2004, where there really wasn't a question. The closer that the national vote comes to determining the winner, the more likely we are to see a different outcome between the two mechanisms, right? So if we have a close election, then we're more likely to see the Electoral College. We're likely to see the biases of the Electoral Colleges on display, right? Because the Electoral Colleges is biased in the favor of smaller states because by design. And so we are more likely to see that. And certainly in the case of something like a Bush-Clinton November election, you're going to see a very divided country, and the outcome of the Electoral College will be that much more improbable. It's also the case that we're seeing the tipping point state, that is the state that's really needed to make the difference between victory and defeat. It's been Colorado for the last few years, but Ohio and Pennsylvania and a number of these states, you know, are very closely divided states internally. And so that's where you start getting these unusual outcomes between the Electoral College and the national vote. Yeah.
Lindsay, I understand that you've either done some research or looked at seriously issues of voting rights and how we deal with manipulation of voting rights. I'd like to believe that that's not an issue anymore. You know, I lived through the 60s, but obviously it is still an issue. What are your thoughts on how that's a struggle we still are continuing with, or is the media just convincing me that it's a struggle we are continuing with that doesn't exist?
Oh, no, it's absolutely still a struggle that we're living with. In every election, whether it's just a local election or a national election, we can point to many instances where there are polling places where, you know, long lines or some of the voter ID laws that have been put in place are making it very difficult for some voters to actually cast their vote. So it's definitely still an issue. You know, we're all in California where perhaps we see less evidence of this, but as we've been reading about just in the last couple of weeks with the conversation about the Voting Rights Act, it's still very much a problem in the American South.
Yeah, I mean, I live in an area of the county where the voter turnout is probably in the mid 60%, and I've never waited to vote more than about a minute and a half. I'm surprised when I hear about these places where people wait in line for hours, and I'm wondering. I want to know why it still works that way, and I realize that may be a question that's a philosophical question we could go on for days, but I'm surprised that there are places where people literally can't vote on their lunch break or their dinner break or before they've got to get home to their kids. But we do have a Supreme Court who has said in the last term that there are actually two terms ago, I guess, that there were restrictions of the Voting Rights Act that shouldn't be around anymore. So I don't know how we address that as a concerned populace.
Right. I think it's a good sort of indication of the larger story of race relations, where sort of on the surface we can say that we've made leaps and bounds, right? That there's been all of this progress, and certainly the rationale behind the Voting Rights Act and the Supreme Court's decision there was that it's been so long, right? It's been 50 years. Clearly, we've sort of overcome all of these issues when, of course, that's not the case. And so just in terms more broadly of race relations, I think we can say the same thing. You know, when Obama was elected in 2008, it was all this talk of a post-racial America, and that just is not the case at all.
Do we have candidates at all that are talking about this, or is it just an issue? It's an underlying theme that doesn't seem to either play well in the media or get much exposure.
Well, in terms of race relations, some of the most recent polls have shown that race relations is in the top eight issues that voters are saying is either extremely important to them or very important to them. It is a huge gap between Democrats and Republicans. So Democrats, by an 18-point lead, are saying that this is an issue that's very important to them. But regardless, it's more than half of the eligible voting public that is saying we need to talk more broadly about race relations and that they will be paying attention to this in the election. What's interesting, I think, is that the most recent surveys put it just below immigration. And so while immigration is taking not sort of center stage right now, but it definitely has a prominent place in the debates and in some of the comments that are made to the media by the candidates, they're going to have to start to follow public opinion. And candidates usually do follow public opinion in terms of what they discuss and start to talk about race relations, because just in the last 2 years, we're seeing some real negativity toward how both blacks and whites and Hispanics and all sorts of different minority groups view race relations in America, so generally viewing it much more negatively today than they have at any point really in the past 15 years. So we're going to have to see the candidates start to pick up this issue.
Yeah, it seems to have gone beyond voting rights, which for some people, I guess it's been an unfortunate negative because it's been dealing a lot with issues of alleged police violence, race, people not being dealt with by people in authority in an honorable and ethical manner, primarily with law enforcement. That seems to have separated out and or pushed people away from looking at the voting rights side of this. That would be a concern if it was a primary issue in your community or in your point of view as to what is or is not a factor in who you vote for. Has that pushed the voting rights issue off to the side because there's been a tremendous amount of media coverage of violence against minority populations?
Well, I think too, for instance, with the candidate for the Republican nomination, the Republican Party has been very clear nationally, and party elites have been very clear in saying that they support voter ID laws. So that's sort of at the heart of the Voting Rights Act and some of the challenges to the Voting Rights Act. And so the candidates would be put in a very difficult position to go against the party on that particular issue. So if they sort of said, you know, we need to keep some of that cognizance in these southern states and sort of this oversight in the southern states in terms of making sure that voters aren't disenfranchised, that would put them in a position then of having to say that they perhaps don't agree with their party on the issue of identification laws. And, of course, at this early stage and with this many candidates, that would put them in a very vulnerable position. And so my guess is that they are just sort of trying to avoid the issue right now.
Hmm. I want to get back to a topic we talked about briefly, and that was the Electoral College being a factor. And I guess there's an organization called the National Popular – not an organization. It's a movement, or I don't know who gave it its title, the National Popular Vote Movement, which, Michael, I think you had mentioned to me once before, is a way to work around the constitutional amendment that would be needed to alleviate the Electoral College. That may not be a big issue, but I'm wondering if it's an issue that that could be used as that is being used or could be used as a grassroots issue to mobilize disenfranchised voters.
Sure, I don't think it becomes an issue until there's another Bush v. Gore, until there's another election where you get two different outcomes, because then people will be enraged and they'll support reform. But I think that the two issues that are much more likely to support reform, and we could do away with the Electoral College. It would basically be a sort of interstate commerce act that would allocate electoral votes to the national popular vote winner. And that movement actually gained a lot of ground after 2000 because there is something I think that most citizens recognize is inherently anti-democratic when the national popular vote winner does not is not the winner of the office. It sort of violates the basic principle of majority rule. But two issues that I think are much more likely to gain traction and continue to gain traction have to do directly with voting rights and also with campaign finance reform, because those are two issues where even though the voting rights movement, and I think that it's a particularly salient topic on the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act, there has been a lot of court activity. Mm-hmm. There's been a lot of litigation. There are going to be 15 new states that have implemented more restrictive voter ID laws, and we're going to be seeing the effects of those laws for the first time in 2016. And yeah. So we're still very early in this process in looking at this new sort of voting rights regime and the attempt of state legislatures to shape electorates in a way that are more favorable to one party than the other. And so we're going to see the outcomes of that litigation in North Carolina and Alabama have already had lawsuits. And that ties back into the voting rights question, the question of partisan versus racial gerrymandering, and the legacy of the Voting Rights Act and what we as citizens need to do to keep those reforms in place and to, frankly, improve voting. My sense is that eventually we'll get to a place where we're not talking specifically about racial groups or any particular identity groups. We'll be talking and focusing more on political equality. And any law that makes it more difficult to vote or makes it makes the value of one's vote count more for one class of people than another people ought to receive a lot of constitutional scrutiny.
Good point. Lindsay, we've got a few minutes left. I'd like to give both of you an opportunity to maybe steer this discussion briefly in the direction of what you think we're not paying attention to that we should be paying attention to, or what you think we're paying attention to for all the wrong reasons, I guess.
Where do I start? I'll go with the obvious that we're paying too much attention to Donald Trump. I think, you know, I study race relations, and so I've already talked a little bit about that. And as I mentioned, that's something that I would like to see candidates speak about both in this early stage, but also once we move to the general election. Another thing that I think is sort of interesting is the way that we've sort of seen issues like terrorism and foreign affairs sort of fall in terms of the level of importance that voters are giving these particular areas. So a little bit more of a focus on domestic issues in this particular election. And then I think the last thing I would say is just paying attention to the youth. And, you know, Mike and I both teach college and typically still a very traditional college age student, the 18 to 22-year-old. And I think that we would both say, you know, they've gotten a bad rap as being apathetic and not involved and that their voter turnout rates are low. And I think we could probably say that we see the exact opposite. These are very enthusiastic young people, and they do vote, and they also participate in a number of other ways that are often very impactful. So demonstrating and protesting in peaceful ways, I should add. So I think we need to pay attention to this up-and-coming group and these millennials that are going to decide the election in some key states.
Okay. Thank you. Michael.
I would follow up on that a bit by looking at the issues that young people care about. And what is of tremendous interest to me is that the reform efforts that many young people are getting behind are not partisan in nature. They're not, you know, for a particular immigration law or against a particular immigration law. And they tend to not fall into that clear partisan lens. And there are a number of institutional reforms that I would mention, and I would obviously like to see a lot more attention paid to as someone who studies institutions for a living. and you know, that goes back to the question of voting rights and the barriers that we place on voting. On the one hand, we see these more restrictive measures being put into place, but there is also movement in the other direction. There's a movement for greater disclosure. In California, we have currently a bill in the Assembly, the California Disclose Act, and that's passed through the Senate. It would expand the disclosure laws for campaign finance disclosure that would put the three largest funders of any political ad to be clearly defined on all advertisements. There's strong support for disclosure on both sides of the ideological bench. Antonin Scalia is one of the strongest advocates for full disclosure, for example. Mm-hmm. And so I think we need to be paying more attention to that to open up our political process and also to reduce the barriers for voting. The state of Oregon has gone to a universal registration system, and so rather than putting the burden on voters to register and to possibly not be eligible to vote in an election, the Oregonians are automatically registered to vote if they have a driver's license. That obviously doesn't cover everyone. We could probably do better, and there's no reason why we shouldn't. And again, that's not a partisan issue. That's a question of political equality. And so I think that if we paid more attention to improving the quality of the process by which we elect people to office, we'd end up being more satisfied with the results that we get.
Yeah. We've got a couple of more minutes left. You both have brought up a point that I'd like to visit briefly if we can, because what I've seen is a lot of discussion about the younger voter. A lot of them are very conservative, but they are socially tend to be somewhat liberal. So we're seeing some economic and world political view people of the youth that are rather conservative in those views. But they're very, very liberal or leaning liberal for the population. There's been a lot of discussion about the fact that the movement in gay rights over the last 3 years has been driven a lot by that population. Are either party paying attention to that? I mean, the Democrats need to look at people who may be leaning towards Democrats but are more world affairs conservative and economically conservative than Democrats have historically been, and the flip side is the same on the Republicans. You got a couple of minutes. Jump in, guys.
Well, I think Democrats see the writing on the wall, and so they're at an advantage here.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Being the party of social reform and cultural culturally on the left, they're going to benefit as through generational replacement. Literally, as old people die and young people come into the system, that's an advantage for them. I think that you're starting – I mean, the struggle is taking place within the Republican Party, clearly, because they're not at a point where they can give up, you know, the support of rank-and-file older voters, but they see the writing on the wall as well.
Yeah. Lindsay, you get the last word.
Yeah, I would agree with Mike that it's
Oh, I would never use that as the last word, Lindsay. Go ahead.
But it's just more of a struggle, I think, in the Republican Party with some of the factions that they are trying to paper over right now. You know, they've always sort of been a party of strange bedfellows of, you know, more libertarian and combined with the more evangelical. And that's always been a difficult partnership. But with the youth vote in particular, you know, I'm at an evangelical Christian school where many of the students are conservative because of their evangelical background. But in terms of gay rights, that was one issue where, and this is just anecdotally speaking, they tended to lean very liberal, and they tended to see this as an issue whose sort of time had come. And so that's going to be very difficult for the Republican Party to try to retain their vote, but also speak to them and appeal to them in a way that they understand and that they agree with.
Yeah. That issue or how those issues are addressed may be what we look at long term, in my opinion, as maybe the canary in the coal mine. We'll get a better understanding of where we're going because those people who you talk about as a rather conservative Christian schools populace have become surprisingly liberal on that one topic, I guess.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And again, a way to end it would be to say that's why I think we do need to pay attention to this generation because they bring a really unique perspective and they don't sort of follow the establishment, and they have this new point of view, or maybe I don't call it new point of view, but they are a very engaged group that just is sort of combining different points of view in different ways, and the parties are going to have to figure out how to bring them into the fold.
Thank you, and we'll have to leave it with that today. Thanks very much. I appreciate it. This is Central Coast Voices, and I want to let you know that we're glad that you were with us today for a very, very topical conversation. Central Coast Voices is a production of Action for Healthy Communities, a project of the Community Foundation of San Luis Obispo County. Next week, I will be with you again as we juggle some vacation schedules, and then Chris Kingdom will be back in a couple of weeks. Next week, I'll be joined by presenters and participants who are part of the upcoming Cuesta College Writers Conference, and that should be a lively discussion about a very fascinating topic to me, which is how writers look at what they do and how they learn to be better writers. Central Coast Voices, as I said, is an Action for Healthy Communities project in collaboration with KCBX. This program is underwritten by a grant from Joan Gillard Sargent. And input to Central Coast Voices can be made at voices@kcbx.org, or you can give us a call at 543-2323. Thank you to my guests today, Michael Latner and Lindsay Lupo, and I appreciate you very much for being part of this program. This has been Central Coast Voices.